Blog Talk Radio.
Is never
before been heard, from what I said. I don't even know what's going on as far as that goes. We couldn't get into it last time just because of all the technical issues that we had. About new developments and new information that's coming out about it. So we all get to hear it, and we get to hear it first.
Yay. I'm
excited. Yeah. Kevin is now with us. Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey, could you do me a favor?
Are you on the internet? Are you on the internet, Matt?
Yes, I am.
Could you go to Unknown Radio Network fan page and post some sites that, like, you know, the people who are listening can go to and just kind of look up, you know, a little bit more information? Is there anything on the internet about this?
Yes, I can look at also
while we proceed.
Yes, there is just so much. what I'll do. I will get that up shortly.
Okay, so you know what? I heard rumors about this. Like, I haven't really researched it, so this is all going to be new to me. But I have heard about the location where this man apparently lived. And it's in Chicago, right?
Yes, his. Basically, I'll give a quick synopsis of his history. Is he went to school in University of Michigan and got his doctorate. I'll take one step previous to that. Growing up as a kid, he was kind of bullied and all through school. Well, what had happened is there were some kids that were in the science lab, and there was a skeleton for just research, you know, demonstration, stuff like that, in school. Well, the kids kind of were messing with him, you know, touch it. Well, they threw it on him, and it landed on top of him. It was a very, very tragic situation for him. And
right.
What had happened after that is he became fascinated with it. He became fascinated with the human body. So he went to school at University of Michigan and went through and ended up getting his doctorate. And I'm not going to get too much into it because Dane and Mark will blow your mind with the amount of research that they've done on who he met, what he did, all that stuff. So he ended up getting his doctorate through University of Michigan, then ended up coming to Chicago after that. He got a job at a pharmacy. Well, after when he got the job at the pharmacy, which is at 63rd and Wallace, which is now the neighborhood of Englewood, and he's Ronald McDonald in that neighborhood now from the people who live. It's a very, very bad neighborhood. So he got the job at the pharmacy. The husband of it was a husband and wife mom and pop shop that owned it. Well, the husband ended up passing away, so it was left to the wife, and he started kind of running it. And I'll leave it at his first victim was probably the woman who owned the pharmacy, ended up taking it over, moved it across the street, and then built what's known as the murder castle. There were rooms that were developed in this hotel that he was running. He would hire immigrant women to work in the hotel that didn't have any ties. He'd work out insurance policies and stuff for him for life insurance. They'd mysteriously disappear, but he was the beneficiary for it. So that's kind of how all this started. Like I said, I'll let Mark and Dane get into a little bit more, but that's pretty much in a nutshell what it is.
What years was this taking place?
It was right around the turn of the century during the Chicago World's Fair. Obviously not when he was in, the White City is an interesting situation in itself. One of the last remaining buildings is the Field Museum. The planetarium was part of it also. The White City was kind of constructed to look like marble, but it was made out of just basically a bunch of crap. Chicago was trying to be on the up-and-coming forefront in that, and they wanted to have this glorious, just gorgeous backdrop, setting, everything. So they had this big thing that was built. Well, Holmes, being the criminal mastermind that he was, actually put the murder castle in a place to where people from the World's Fair that were visiting for it put it in a place to where they'd stay in his hotel, while not knowing that his hotel was developed and designed to kill people. So he had gas chamber rooms. He had everything. So people would check in, but they'd never check out.
Yeah, I know of another place like that. Charleston Old City Jail. They had a serial killer, like a couple serial killer there. And they had like a little hotel, and basically they had a bed that would fall into the floor somehow, or somehow like they were stabbed to death. The lady would lure men back to the hotel and then like give them tea and pass them out, and then like the bed would kill them, and then they'd steal all their money and everything and get rid of the bodies. And
yeah.
They got busted. But yeah, so another.
Well, there's been people throughout history that to where, and this is something that I've been contributing with all this information and my research of it, to where human worth didn't really have as much meaning. There wasn't as much morality as there is today. So
right.
there was a doctor. His name was Dr. Knox, and this was at the beginning of the 19th century. It was the 1811 through 1831 that he had these two guys that were kind of his lackeys that ran kind of the same thing, more of a not really a hotel, but not like an apartment. It was kind of like a extended stay, if you will. And what they would do is these two guys would end up killing this. They kill the patrons that were staying there, and they take the body of Dr. Knox. Well, Dr. Knox, he never questioned where the bodies came from, but they always had these fresh bodies that he would be able to do these autopsies and stuff in a classroom setting. So
right.
he'd pay them $75, and back in the early 1800s, $75 was, you know, right around $1,000, $1,500 today.
Right.
So he'd pay them, and then they'd do that. Well, there's a lot of cases, if you look back through, and it's kind of was big business back then.
Yeah. Well, you know, they wanted to find out what was going on inside us.
Yes. And go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to throw in that what's crazy about H.H. Holmes was the only reason he got caught wasn't because of the murders, it was because of insurance fraud. He got arrested for that, and then when they started poking around in that hotel, that's when they discovered human remains and whatnot, and that's how it all fell into place with him.
Yeah. And, Dane was with us and then dropped out. I really hope we're not having these problems again, boss.
Well, it's got to be on his end. He might be having signal issues. Who knows?
Well, we had both Mark and Dane. Mark, I see him pop up. Oh, Dane's back. Let's see if I bring him in, if that just keeps that connection. Hey, Dane, you with us?
I'm with you there, Matt. I had a bad connection. I had to call back.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen Mark pop in a couple times here and there and try to bring him in, but every time I go to hit active, he's just gone. So, well, we have a little different setup for the evening. Dane, we have Jody Parks and Kevin, who basically runs Unknown Radio Network, is going to be along with the discussion with us. So, but how's your night going, Dane?
It's going good. I was listening to the first part there you were talking about, and you know, there's a few things that I will have to call you on, but let's get going on the discussion first. You know, you surprised me with a few things there, Matt. We sat and talked about this in detail, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite all right. It's just another Wednesday night, and love doing the show and love talking, especially talking to you guys. Yeah, your research of what you do is a lot more in depth than what I've been able to come across in anything that I've done. So that's why you're way more the expert than I am on this.
Well, I spend most of my days double digit hours doing nothing but research, and when you come across an individual like Holmes, the more you research, the more you come up with. And it's easy to see how you can just get engrossed in research about Holmes. He's a fascinating individual. When you compile that with the research over the last 40 years that I've been doing on Jack the Ripper, seeing all these avenues opening up, it's just remarkable. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I definitely. Oh, here you go. This would be the point that I would have to say, and I am humbled to have you do this. But yes, you can call me out on whatever you'd like right now.
Okay, you were explaining to Jody the early life of Herman, and you mentioned the situation with him with the skeleton. And we went over that last week a little bit. My research, I was able to come up with a very different take on that than most of your history books and nonfiction books have stated over the past several decades. As I mentioned last week, I'm working very closely with the National Archives of U.S., and I'm working closely with Scotland Yard and with the Metropolitan Police in London. I also have been working very closely with several members of the Mudgett family, and several of them who still live in Herman's hometown of Gilmanton, New Hampshire. It turns out that I was given the blessing of being able to look at some family notes, historical records, and I was able to see records of this incident that is so widely known and misrepresented as the one incident that changed Herman's life, which was the alleged skeleton falling on him. Well, what it actually was is his elder classmates, he was a young boy around 9 years old, they would constantly follow him home and torment him. He was a small boy for his age. And he was a good-looking boy, and he was always received the attention from the girls. They liked him. He also was very educated, so the teachers really took to him. Well, you can imagine, all of us who've been to school, so the bigger boys who are not popular, the bullies, they don't like kids like that. They don't like boys like that. They tend to pick on them. Well, they would follow him home from school. And Herman always would pass. He'd take the same path home, and he would always pass by this one house. It was a house and a doctor's residence, which had a barn. It was a farm, and it was known through the town as the doctor's house. It turns out that one day these boys followed him when they were in front of the doctor's house, and they saw that Herman had stopped in front of this doctor's house because Herman would often stop there and look and peek through the window. The smells emitting from there, you can imagine walking in that day and age, walking through within any vicinity of somewhere where medicines, surgery, and including deceased bodies were kept, the smells would arouse your senses. So he'd walk by this doctor's house, his office, and this one particular day, these boys happened to shove him through the door. And when they did, they were picking on him and making fun of him. And one of the boys, it's documented that he grabbed the end of a white sheet that was on a mound of what they thought were was laundry on a gurney. And he pulled, hoping that all this laundry would fall on top of Herman and just to harass him. Well, it was a deceased body. The doctor, Dr. Nahum White, who owned the property and who was the doctor, the town doctor, he had gone out on a house call. And he was also the town surgeon, and he prepared deceased bodies before they went to the funeral home. When this body fell on top of Herman, he stared into the eyes or the face of a corpse. That's what scared him so. Not an articulated skeleton. You know, I recall the days when I was in school, even at the age of 9, 10, 11, I saw skeletons hanging in the corner. They were not frightening enough to give me a life-altering change to turn me into a fiend, a monstrous fiend. However, I cannot imagine what it would be like to be trapped underneath a corpse staring me in the face at 9 years old and not being able to move, being frozen still, and then realizing in one single split moment that you're no longer afraid, but you're actually enticed and entranced by this corpse. Well, as it turns out, Dr. Nahum White had come back, and the records indicate that he came back and he found Herman on the floor underneath this corpse. Dr. Nahum White took Herman under his wing. When Herman Mudgett went to go to medical school, Dr. Nahum White gave Herman a letter of recommendation on record for medical school. They had a connection. That was his turning point in life. That is when he started to his fascination with cadavers. Now, you made mention that Herman first killed for money. I believe you said it was when he was in school, in college. Well, it seems that that could be possible. However, there was a situation when Herman was a young man, a young boy, and he had a friend who history records Herman and he were out investigating an abandoned house, and this friend of Herman's, the only friend Herman had, met with a very peculiar end in life. He somehow, from a second floor, found his way outside of a window onto the wooden walkway. At that time, that's what they had for walkways, a little wooden walkway porch, if you will. And his friend was had a broken neck, and he died right then and there. Herman said that he saw his friend up there. The next thing he knew, his friend was going out the window. Did not know how he went out the window or why. Well, at that time, they were suspicious that it may have been Herman who had killed him. However, they did not have any proof, so they did not pursue it. Looking back, the investigator on the scene had stated that, later in life, had stated that he was positive that Herman had killed his friend. Now, you also mentioned about 63rd and Wallace.
Yes.
And if you can just refresh my memory what you were mentioning about there and his swindle at 63rd and Wallace.
Basically all I was saying about it, I was just running through a quick thing because I was trying to get Mark on and you on it, and so I was doing a couple things at once and just going off a quick memory. Well, 63rd and Wallace is the site of where the murder castle was. I didn't even get into that it's a post office now, that it's still an open functioning post office. I was talking about how it's not the best neighborhood and you really, really don't want to walk around there too late at night. But the site of the murder castle isn't where the site of where the initial pharmacy was, which was across the street where there's, I believe, if I remember right, it's an Aldi now.
It is, and it was, at the time, it was E.S. Holton's drugstore. And E.S. Holton owned it. At the time, he was suffering from cancer, but his wife worked at the store. And in true Holmes fashion, Holmes befriended E.S. Holton's wife, and Mrs. Holton entrusted Holmes with the business. Ended up in signing the business over to Holmes. He insured it. He actually did a whole lot more than that, which will come out in my book. But he promised, signed a promissory note to buy the business from Mrs. Holton, and he did not pay his debt to Mrs. Holton, and she threatened to sue him, actually went to an attorney to sue him. All of a sudden, there's no more Mrs. Holton. She was gone.
And has there been any, because initially when we started this, and I never heard anything about this since then, and that's what I've been trying to figure out, but I can't find anything on it. Initially, he basically forged a letter saying that she went to visit her sister or her cousin in California and loved it so much she decided that she was going to stay there, which is how the business got signed over. and nobody even questioned
right.
it because he was such he was such an amazing staple in the community. I mean, he was friends with the mayor. He was, you know, like everybody loved him, so nobody ever questioned it. But I
were questioning it, and when they started questioning why she never returned, then Holmes started changing his story and saying that she enjoyed California. She decided she wanted to stay there with her family and live there. And that's why they did not pursue it.
Yeah, and that's where I could, like, I can't find yay or nay on any of that of if there wasn't, like, because I was always under the assumption that there was a letter that was, that's why that it was called off was because of a letter that was basically a forgery that he did.
Right. Right. And that's why the trail ended there is because Mr. Holton had died from his cancer. Mrs. Holton had just disappeared. And we know that she disappeared because Holmes had murdered her for the business. And right after they disappeared, as they had entrusted him with the business, he made off with the business, made off with the money, and he, with money from that drugstore, he bought the property right across the street where he built his three-story murder castle, which was going to be a hotel for the Columbian Exposition, the World's Fair, in 1893.
Yeah. So, Jody, now that you're a little more caught up to speed, do you have any questions on this?
Yeah. How does it go back to Jack the Ripper?
Well,
we talk a lot about while he's here, right?
There's a lot that drags him into that arena. When you look at the Jack the Ripper crimes, as I was pointing out last week, you look at from the period of 1888 to 1892, there were a total of 21 Ripper victims. Now, over the years, there were many of those Ripper victims had been dispelled as being victims for one reason or another, and mostly because other murderers had been tied to their murder. And now we have what's left is the canonical five victims that are left that are believed to be the five actual Ripper victims, which is Marianne Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly, all in the East End of London in the Whitechapel district. Now, when you look at those five individuals, when you compare case file evidence and you compare everything with Ripper case file evidence, statements, witness testimonies, and there were eyewitnesses to the Ripper murders, and then you in turn compare with H.H. Holmes and his case file evidence, testimony from the trial, testimony of witnesses, and you start digging and looking at evidence of the witnesses and of Holmes, you start seeing where they start crossing. They intersect, and you start seeing Holmes for what he is, which is the prime suspect And here's where I'm going to throw this out. And Matt, you've not heard this yet.
No, I have not.
Out of these canonical five, and this is where we were going to end up last week, and we got cut off. Out of the canonical five Ripper victims, with my book, it will come out. That list of five victims will be shortened as Dr. H.H. Holmes can be tied into two of those victims' murders, leaving three of them to another murderer.
Wow.
Well,
so there were two murderers at one time?
Within a short period of time.
Well,
that's
Shane,
interesting.
And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but in the five murders, the first two, which is, and possibly three, would fit the MO of the precision of Holmes. The other two were, or the last two or three, were pretty much just a complete mutilation, almost like a copycat, or if in fact he did have a student that he was training, that was or just somebody who was a complete copycat that just didn't have the surgical precision of the ones that are suspected to be the Holmes murders.
Well, two of the first three would fit Holmes's MO. The last two, I agree with you. They do not. The remaining one of the first three, I have my research has revealed that Holmes was assisted.
Yeah. I can see that.
And thus, there is another murderer connected to that one of the first three. And I'm not going to reveal names and such right now. You know, I'm sorry, you're going to have to read the book. It's going to change history. It's going to change history as we know it. But it's black and white, and it shows it in the evidence.
Yeah, because that was one thing in what I've been looking at in the MO of Holmes versus first killing to last killing, especially in the Whitechapel situation. The third one was the one that's like, it kind of does, but it doesn't. And then the last two were just sloppy, messy. I mean, they're no. It seems, and this is where, I'll start to bring out a little more of the psyche. The last ones either seem completely just no knowledge of the human body from a surgical standpoint, or
correct,
absolute complete rage.
Correct.
And
correct.
That's where the one in the middle, that third one, if there were six, I'd be happier than five. That sounds
right.
Horrible. But the reason being is you could tell, and at that point, it's that transitionary period to where it does seem like there was an assistant or there was somebody who just got a little bit carried away or didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Correct. Correct. And, a few other very odd things, I'll just have to leave it at odd, that I'd like to point out is, and I've been meaning to ask you, Mark has not phoned in yet, has he?
I actually just talked to him on Facebook chat. He is getting no reception at his house, so he's going to be calling in from McDonald's. and he's on his way there now.
Oh, okay, good.
He's a hell of a trooper, man.
Now, Holmes had many aliases. And I have found on Kennard Shipline's manifest a few of those aliases. You know, he went by Henry Howard Holmes, Henry Mansfield, Howard D.T. Pratt, Harry or Henry Gordon, he used both, Edward Hatch, J.A. Judson, Alexander E. Cook, A.C. Hayes, George H. Howell, G.D. Hale. I'm just naming them off the top of my head, trying to remember. Mr. Hall, H.H. Howard. These are all names that he's used. And there's more. Those are just a few I threw out there. His relationship that we know of, that has been given to us historically, with his helpers, if you will, his assistants, his comrades, Benjamin Peitzel,
yes,
are so skewed and have been so skewed. It's unbelievable, the information I found on him when I started digging. And I'll take a lesser-known one. He spent some time in jail with Marion Hedgepeth. Now, as you know, Marion Hedgepeth was the individual who actually came forth and informed the authorities that Holmes was intending to defraud the insurance company. He actually cut a deal, Hedgepeth did, to get out of prison. And it worked. It cut his sentence shorter. But Hedgepeth, he's he was the epitome of a Jesse James. He was a cowboy. He was known as the Handsome Bandit, the Debonair Bandit, the Derby Kid, the Montana Bandit. He was famous in the Wild West. He really was. And my book actually goes into a section on him because it delves into his history. I have a thesis, a conjecture, that his involving the authorities in H.H. Holmes' schemes, insurance scam, and the allegation of $500 that was never paid to him by H.H. Holmes for providing an attorney and so on to work the scheme out, was actually all a plan from the very get-go between he and Holmes. Hedgepeth he also used a few of his aliases to meet up with Holmes when Holmes was visiting Edmund Buckley, his college mate in London. Hedgepeth actually went out there and he met up with Holmes and Buckley. And the history records didn't say anything about that. Probably because they didn't dig enough, but, you know, that's all I've got is time on my hands, right?
Yeah, and that's in Piercing the Veils of Death, or that's the book that's going to be coming out?
No, the one that's going to be coming out. the one that's going to be coming out, Dr. H.H. Holmes and the Whitechapel Ripper.
Yeah. I personally know that, but I was just saying just in general. But, yeah, Stain's other book, Piercing the Veils of Death, is a ridiculously phenomenal read. I have it on ebook. And Dane, man, I still love you for that. Dane came to my work and dropped off an autographed copy for me of actual hardcover, and it is seriously a phenomenal book. I'm not just saying that because I'm friends with you. I'm saying it because it's the honest to God truth. Like your articulation and everything that just in the structure of the book, it sucks you in, and it does really keep you. And I have to applaud you on truly, truly one of the best books I've ever read.
Well, Matt, you know, I think the world of you. You're a great guy. You don't have a mean bone in your body. You help anybody and everybody that you can. You've had me on your show a number of times, and you know, we've gone out and at both work related events and social events, and you know, I can't say enough how much I appreciate the things that you have done for me in helping me and encouraging me and in supporting me. You know, it's just that's what we need to have more of in this world. We really do.
Well,
I agree
thank
with
you,
Matt. Matt is a wonderful person.
Yeah.
See, there you go, Matt.
And Jody, you know what? The only person that's left in the dark in this is Kevin. Dana, I talked to you about it. Jody, you know about it. We've talked about it. That's a huge reason why I can't really say too much about it or anything, as I've been very, very vague, but about the project of the book that I'm trying to put together. So... And Dana, I know we'll talk about it later. Jody, I know we've talked about it. Kevin, I will let you know later. I haven't talked to you about it, buddy. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I heard some of it on Monday's show, and you and I chatted a little bit about it, but I know what you're talking about.
All right. So, yeah, and you know, it's my thing, and Dane, I mean, you also know me. I'm not one to blow smoke up anybody's ass. Like, I really did, I mean, enjoy the book as in one of those things to where it's going to be ingrained in my brain as one of the best books I've ever read, and that's the honest to God truth.
Right. Well, you know, what my mission is to set the story straight with real hardcore investigation and research. To show the facts, you know, and I also want to present people, you know, I ask all the time on my Facebook page, on my website, I want people to give me their honest to God opinions and questions. What turns them on when it comes to wanting to know about Holmes? I get such things as how many children did Holmes have? How many wives did he have? Things like that. And I want to put that out. I want to research that to the nth degree, put that in my book for everyone to know. Not to make them fall asleep, but just so that they have more insight to what made Holmes tick. Because I think right now, as a society, with the way our nation is, and globally with the way the world is, with respect to terrorism, with the respect to serial killers and crime, we want to know what makes these people tick. Why does somebody get to that edge and then jump in? And that is why, in turn,
yeah.
I also interviewed and currently interviewing and corresponding with a known serial killer that I'll be including in my book, just so that I can have that contemporary perspective of why an individual kills 9 women in a period of a few years, you know, in 4 different states. And it's a phenomenal interview, you know, and I'm learning a lot from it.
I bet
but,
you are.
It's scary to think that these people could live right next door. They could be Uncle John or you know, Aunt Margaret. I mean, it's just
you could take your kids around them, you know, your family.
Yeah.
And, you know,
right.
You don't even know. It's scary. People are scary. I'm more frightened of the living than I am of the dead, which brings me to, has anybody investigated the locations where he was possibly killing these people?
Well, actually, I have been to 63rd and Wallace, the murder castle site. I've also gone to the glass factory site where he had a glass factory where he was allegedly incinerating the remains of individuals. And at the Holmes murder castle site, the investigators of the day called it the Holmes Cemetery because there were so many bodies that were buried on the site. But I've been to these sites, and as Matt said, at 63rd and Wallace, you want to go in a group, you want to go during the day, if you go at all. It's an oppressed area.
Right.
And the ironically, what's built down there right now is a United States post office facility. And why that's so ironic is because Herman Webster Mudgett, Dr. H.H. Holmes, his father, after he was a magistrate, after he was a successful farmer, he ended his last days working. He was a postal carrier for the U.S. Post Office. And that's just bizarre. Levi Mudgett, his father, was a post carrier, and they built a post office on that property.
Hmm.
But
how many bodies did they find on the property?
They stopped on that property. They stopped at 20. However, they claim that if they kept digging, they could have found up to 200 or more. Now, oddly enough, and Jeff Mudgett he's a very good friend of mine, and he wrote the book Bloodstains. He had tried to petition, and he's continually trying to petition to have that area excavated because he believes that there are still remains there on the ground. When that post office was built, they never properly excavated that grounds. There could most certainly still be remains on that property.
Wow. So has anybody collected evidence possibly there, or is there any activity whatsoever?
Well, Jeff Mudgett has gone in the basement with a crew, and he's been on television. Actually, he's going to be on again this coming Monday night on Fox Television, and at 9 o'clock. and there's going to be a segment about him going in the basement. He's gone in, and he's experienced some things. And actually, for my book, Piercing the Veils of Death, I went with a paranormal group, 263rd and Wallace, for that very purpose. And oddly enough, there was one, only one, what I would call anomaly, which I did post on SoundCloud, of a voice that was captured. I had my assistant with me, Dean Thompson, and he and I, we were standing by a tree in the front of the post office. This tree is allegedly where the chute would have been, where the bodies would have slid down and out for Holmes to get rid of the bodies. My assistant and I, we were standing there. He and I, we were the only two individuals there. And there were no other people within. The closest was across the street, so a good 100, what would you say, Matt? That's about 150 yards across the street from that tree?
Probably right around there, yeah.
So 150 yards away. And there was one lady, and she was just walking. I had a high-definition digital tape recorder going while him and I were just talking and walking around, discussing the looks of the place, discussing the train tracks adjacent it, and discussing the elevated trestle behind the post office, because it's the same elevated trestle that was there when Holmes had the murder castle there. Well, there's a spot on the tape where a distinct disembodied voice says, "Mudgett." That's all it says. A female voice. My assistant, who is with a paranormal group, had tried to see what he could do with it and analyzed it forward, backwards, every which way. He came up with the conclusion that it is a disembodied voice, nothing more, nothing less. He cannot explain it because there was no one within our vicinity. Mind you, that day, and I will say this, that day Jeff Mudgett was supposed to meet us there on the property. Could this female have been calling out to Jeff Mudgett, or could this female have known H.H. Holmes' real name, Herman Mudgett, and been calling him?
That's what I've been wondering, too, how many people actually back in the, and there's no way to actually know this, but how many people that he had encountered or come across back in the day actually known his true real name?
Well, you would be surprised. You would be surprised. There were quite a few that did know his name, and oddly enough, there were quite a few that should have known his name that didn't. He had, at the time of his conviction, for argument's sake, we'll say he had five wives. None had known about each other.
I hate to cut you off real quick, but Mark did pop in, so I got to bring him in before he drops off again.
Yes, please, let him talk.
I don't know if that's the issue. Okay, Mark, you with us?
Hey, yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I will take a number two with a diet, please.
I got a chocolate chip for pay.
Yummy.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad that you were able to join us finally. It's starting to seem like a repeat of last week.
Oh, this was it was all on my end. It was really weird. If it's much as goats, I'm gonna kick his butt when I see it. Because I got to go to work and kick his ass. I'm telling you that right now.
Right on.
So,
well, you guys are making me want to go investigate there. Can people get in there to investigate?
Nope.
Well, he pops in. It shows up every once in a while. It's kind of hard to say. Right now, he's teasing one of the bosses and tries to start one of the trucks. It's hilarious.
You know what's weird is Dennis, who we talked or was with me last week, and Dane, I know you know Dennis a lot better than Mark does, but Mark, Dennis in Virginia and Richmond has been hanging out around a towing yard that random stuff happens and like trucks. Like diesel trucks just sitting there will fire up on their own out of nowhere.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, well this is one of our sweeper trucks that wants to start by itself and then they took it to the shop to see what was causing it and they can't find what's causing it. So we're just attributing it to the ghost there. Because I had a run in with him already years ago. I think it was like a test to see if I could handle the job. And that was 8 years ago, I'm still there.
Well, apparently you can handle it then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was funny. It was really, not at the time because it almost busted my hand. The high pressure washer hose blew up in my hand, so I wasn't too happy at the moment.
No, I wouldn't assume so.
No. But then it got comical when the radios started going on by themselves. And at first I thought somebody was playing a trick on me, and then there was just no way it could happen. Because then doors would slam, and then reopen and slam again. So, yeah. He was testing me for about 2 hours.
All right, so we're I don't know how much you've been able to hear. We've basically covered. Okay. We basically covered a lot of the Holmes past, the new developments of Holmes. Dane, right before you called him, was talking about how. Was questioning about how many wives, how many children, stuff like that, and really wants to know that. As far as research that you found out, what's been I would like to get your take on it also. Of just pretty much anything of that you found out in your developments, which I kind of already know, but. Nobody else does.
Well, I tried to send you a picture of the collage that I did with the letter, with the handwriting letter. I didn't know if you got that on your Facebook. I've been having all kind of problems. But anyway, I had put together a nice little visual display, and part of the one picture I did was I have the collage with Ripper letters mixed in with Mudgett letters and pictures of him compared to the original 1888 picture of Jack the Ripper. And then I have alongside of that is the letter that I got from the handwriting expert verifying the match in the handwriting between the Ripper and Mudgett. So that was, I put that all together and then I used that as far as a visual display. And that worked out pretty good when I gave a talk locally here.
Yeah. So what's the most in all this development that I mean we know Jeff we love Jeff and all and everything that he's been doing in this by word and a lot of that and just the case itself is compelling. What's the one thing that about this that sucks you in the most?
How's that again? I'm sorry.
I heard some kind of fun music playing in the background.
Oh, yeah.
What's the one thing about this case that has sucked you in the most, as far as whether it be history and the research, whether it be the case itself, and just getting into the mind of H.H. Holmes, or what?
Well, learning more about him and finding out that what was printed in history about him was not necessarily completely the truth. And so I had to completely come up with or find completely new things, you know, new evidence. I couldn't go back to other people's writing. So Borowski had a great book with the writings of Holmes and the detective and the guy that actually went into the castle itself. So that helped a lot. Borowski's book was fantastic. And then I contacted people from his hometown to get a letter from his college. His college was great. That was one of the greatest things of the whole entire case, was the people that I got to meet along the way. In writing, the people out at the University of Michigan were absolutely fantastic to deal with. I loved working with them, and also the people down in Texas. At San Antonio was just absolutely lovely. I mean, she sent me the greens, not just where the house was. She sent me the floor plans. You know, it was absolutely incredible. These people were absolutely fun and fascinating. At Austin, they were great. And what's really neat with Austin, unlike London or anywhere else, when the crimes happened at the time period, a lot of other places, what was there then is gone. Down in Austin, everything that was there then is still there. So you can see every, almost just the way it was back at the time of the axe murders in 1884 through into 1886. I mean, it's just incredible to see. Got a nice picture from an old map of the house that the girl was killed in San Antonio. And, you know, little stuff like that. It was just absolutely fascinating. And, you know, to find out, you know, to kind of verify some of the theories of the other murders, the Texas murders, the New York murder, that was fascinating with the murder of the prostitute in New York. She went by Shakespeare, and it was just, that was absolutely fascinating. And to find original newspapers that had pictures of the killer, and it matches perfectly with my suspect. It was like, wow, you know, and even handwriting. They even copied the handwriting out of the sign-in book, and it was absolutely perfect to his. It's like unbelievable. And yeah, you know, you just can't ask for any better than that. It's like, wow, you know. And I tried to deal, you know, more and more like that. And I try my reports on Fall River then with the Borden murders. I wanted to get them involved, and I just never heard anything, and that was such a shame, because there is a letter that was sent to Emma Borden, Lizzie's sister, and it matches two Ripper letters almost perfectly. And if I could see the original with the handwriting, I almost guarantee it's Mudgett's.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
absolutely fascinating.
That's definitely something I've never heard before.
Yeah, it was. I was not expecting it, because what happened was, when I was researching the murder in New York, I was trying to figure out why was he there. That didn't make any sense to me, because it wasn't near any rail lines. But I knew he was heading to Boston. So this is where I had to learn about transportation. Well, I found out the biggest way to get to Boston from New York City was to take the Fall River line. The ships, the steamships, and that was the most popular way to go. And they were incredible when you see the pictures of them. And, of course, where does the Fall River line go to? Fall River, from New York to Fall River. The hotel the prostitute was murdered in was one block away from the wharf for the Fall River line. So I had everything was studying old maps and, you know, how things worked at that time. And so that it all just kept coming into place. It was so cool. But, yeah, I was hoping I could get more from – I mean, I have a typed copy of the letter, and it, like I said, it matches perfectly with two Ripper letters. But when I try to get a handwritten version, nobody can seem to get back to me, which is sad.
Yeah, that would be definitely – Damn, I would love to see how that would actually pan out.
Yeah, it was fascinating because when I start, at first I didn't even want to touch it. I did not want to touch the Borden murders at all. I thought, oh, this is just goofy. And then what it ended up happening was, and I never knew this, and most historians don't realize this, is there was a third murder. While Lizzie was in prison, right before her trial, there was a third murder, Bertha Manchester, and that murder matched exactly the murder of a girl down in San Antonio. I mean, it's interesting because the two articles I got were from the New York Times, and it's almost like, you could put the two articles together, and they're almost identical because they give the description of everything, and everything matches. It's absolutely amazing.
That's crazy. So, like, they were all killed, like, the same in the same way? Or just those two?
Oh, boy, you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Yeah, Jody, you were kind of cut out a little bit.
That's bad. Can you hear me now?
A little bit.
Yeah, you sound like you're in the distance.
I'm telling you, it's much as ghosts, and I'm going to kick it.
Well, and, you know, Kevin, I do have to cut it and say, you know, did you catch the two things that that Mark loved the most, and they were in Texas?
Yeah, I saw that.
that's Southern hospitality, and yeah, Mark, Kevin's down in Texas, so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's Texas, and he's not far from where I grew up in Houston.
Oh, cool. Yeah. No, I want to get down to Austin sometime because a lot of it is still there, and there's some things I still want to research down there. Did the author O. Henry have any relationship to Mudgett Holmes in any capacity? As it turned out, he worked at a pharmacy down there, and it was only two doors away from Mudgett's school friend, had an apartment building. And I think that's where I had first thought the idea that's where Mudgett would have stayed, which would have made sense. And then finding out that there's a pharmacy two doors away, and that happened to be where O. Henry happened to be working. And that building actually still exists, and it's the visitor center in Austin.
Oh, interesting. Now, my question about Holmes is, during y'all's research, I'm trying to figure out why Holmes would go to London and do killings. What was the motivation, or what was his purpose for going over there?
So far, what I'm finding out is he may have loaned his college friend some money. And I think he went over to kind of get it back. I think he needed it for his hotel. But that's based off a letter that was a Ripper letter that was made in, that he wrote in London. But it says he just came from San Francisco, and he was going after some money. I tried to look up to see if he was selling any skeleton or body parts, and so far I've come up empty there. I've written and called a whole lot of colleges and haven't gotten anywhere there, but he was into other things too, so I'm still researching that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and here's something too that, and this is in the history books, and I mean, you can look it up on Wikipedia, which we all know how true Wikipedia is. Yes. If you want anything at all, and you want nothing that's fabricated, check out Wikipedia. That's a complete joke. I have seen some truth in other reports and things about this, but I can't get any concrete as far as in his infancy as a killer, as a murderer,
mm-hmm.
that once he started getting a taste for, and this, or this is actually how he got a taste for his acts and what he did, is he would take just random street women in the U.S. He would murder them, dismember their faces, and throw them out in the gutter, and then claim them as his, basically take out a life insurance policy, and then claim them as his kin, sure. and then collect on that policy.
Sure. Well, he did that with the dead bodies from college.
Yeah, but I mean, mm-hmm. that's how he got to that point, though, to realize that, and I mean, with the acid baths, with everything that was in the basement of the murder castle,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of one of those things, like you put your toe in the water to test if it's hot or cold, and then
mm-hmm.
that's kind of where it was, and like, oh yeah, this could work. Yeah, hell?
Yeah. No, he was extremely brilliant. For as crazy as he was extremely brilliant.
Yeah. The one thing, and Dane, I know you and I go back and forth about this all the time, is for the time and what was committed is, I would actually classify him as more of a sociopath than a psychopath.
Well,
so,
we talked about this last week, actually. He had a way of talking to people. He was very inviting. Even in papers that I read concerning his court appearance, that he was so friendly. And so I don't know how much of a sociopath he was, but definitely a psychopath. There's just no doubt about it. But it was like watching, you know, if you read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, it's like you're watching him, but both at the same time. I mean, he could turn at any second. You didn't know, you know, he'd be the kind doctor, and then all of a sudden, he'd be this evil creature. And you, I mean, within a second or two, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of it, too, and I'm just going to touch on it really quick because I know we don't want to get into this. It creates a very, very long conversation, which will take over the 41 minutes we have left. But
and I can't be here that long. They close.
Mark, you should have went to a 24-hour McDonald's. Come on, man. We can do this.
That's what it was.
It'll be a marathon.
Yeah, no, they're open till 11. I'm good. My time,
know,
though.
So basically, the reason that I call it sociopath is a sociopath isn't a psychopath is reduced from society as far as he reduces himself and restricts interaction. Well,
right.
Holmes being a completely social butterfly and brilliant, and being able to hide that demon that was within him,
uh-huh.
is where he was still functioning. He was still he was in society. He wasn't like a lot of the a lot of the people to where you hear the, and I don't mean to bring this up so soon afterwards, but like the MO of like the Columbine kids or, you know,
right.
the Black Trench Coat Mafia, which were outcasts. They were,
they
didn't talk to anybody. They didn't do, you know, they didn't do social functioning. They didn't do any of that stuff. And then they just snapped one day. That's the difference to where that's more a psychopathic behavior. And even Dane, I would love to just have one, even 5 or 10 minute sit down with the gentleman that you were talking to, the, you know, serial killer who killed 9 women. I would love to actually get into his head and just see what direction he was going. There's trigger questions that you learn in a lot of the stuff that I've done in the past and a lot of the people that I've interacted with in the past that you can figure out what sort of mental state just by facial expression, stuff like that. There's a lot of things. And I know it's probably not possible, but yeah, that was one thing that I would have loved to be a part of. Just to see what kind of comparisons, even though we can't. Mark, are you at a little kid's party at McDonald's? Are you wearing a hat?
I should be. I'm watching a cartoon, and right under the music speaker, it's like, wow.
I'm talking about something all dark, and then I hear all this happy, like, I just want to start, like, dancing with and, you know, playing a ukulele or something with a clown hat on. Like, I
unreal, isn't it? This is unreal.
Matt.
Yes.
If I could just address your question of last week and this week of sociopath and psychopath.
Sure.
Okay. When you look at Holmes, when you look at any serial killer, they have both qualities of being a sociopath and a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
Within Holmes' makeup, you know, when you talk about a sociopath, he lacked a real sense of moral responsibility or any type of social conscience, okay? There were people close to him, but he always ended up in killing the people who got close to him. He never really had that one-on-one intimate relationship like you or I would know, which would last years on end. You know, when we're looking at the relationships that Holmes had, even with his wives, you're only talking a period of a few years at best. So he lacked that sense of commitment and social responsibility and moral responsibility. When you talk about psychopathic personality and how it manifests in an individual, their lack of ability to be able to establish meaningful relationships. He definitely fit that mold, as with most, any and all serial killers.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that he wasn't a serial killer, because it's the blatant out there that he was. But all I was saying is that psychopathic is a little bit different. It's where they don't, like, most psychopaths don't have a social conscience to be able to function in society in the forefront like he did. That's where I'm saying the difference comes in.
Now, you're talking about psychopaths, right?
Yeah.
I have to disagree with you there. Take your psychopaths. Give me a list of names of psychopaths, well-known psychopaths. You're going to see names on that list, such as Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy. These are all people who were able to be well adjusted in their communities.
I will give you Jeffrey Dahmer. He definitely was. Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy. Actually, even Jeffrey Dahmer did it. Jeffrey Dahmer functioned in the homosexuality community. Like he would go to gay bars, he would go to truck stops, he would pick up males there. And what he was doing, and yeah, he was in a social setting, but every single report that you see about Jeffrey Dahmer was, as soon as it was a close quarters individual face-to-face thing, there wasn't any, it was an instant switch that was flipped. John Wayne Gacy.
And that's where they were a psychopath, because they lacked that ability to establish a meaningful personal relationship.
Yeah,
they did not have that in their personal makeups.
Let's see, all of those interactions of those three that you brought up were an instantaneous or within a week period thing, not a years and years period thing, and also not having the mental capacity to become a person of interest in politics, and being involved in the community, being the great guy next door. Yes, there are some in the past, but those three instances that you brought up were social outcasts. They were not they weren't at the prestigious level that Holmes was. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, most your killers are outcasts, and that was one of the reasons why they killed, because they were outcasts. They strived for the attention, and Holmes wasn't like that. He never really strived for the attention. He would play it. Oh, absolutely. But that wasn't his goal in the whole thing.
Well, no, we know Holmes was motivated by want of monetary gain and lust. That was his his whole motivation.
Yeah, and that's where I'm saying it's a completely different situation, to where Holmes was Holmes back in the day, and you got to put yourself in an 1800s mindset versus a 1960s, 70s, and 90s
mindset.
Oh,
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Where it was not financially driven, and for Gacy or anybody else in from 1935 and up, most of the time it wasn't a financially driven thing. Back in those times, and back in Holmes' mindset, it was financially driven. So it's a little bit different as far as can you, will I say that he did horrible, horrible, horrible things to people? Yeah. Will I say that it's looked at in a different manner just because of the time frame and what was going on at that time, and even the sex trade was up, where human beings didn't have as much moral value? Yeah. So, taking all that into account is where I'd look at my decision. Was he a psychopath? Yeah. Was he a sociopath? More than a psychopath, but it was a bad cocktail. Let me put it that way.
Well, I think we can all agree on that.
He was bad all the way around, and studying him actually helps you understand more of the criminal style more than any other person, because he just was a do-it-all crook in every respect.
Now, my question is, with Holmes, did he torture his victims? I mean, was it quick deaths or were they slow deaths? And if they were slow deaths, I don't know if that would always, if that would just be financial gain that he's trying, if there was a little bit more to it with his victim.
Well, that's a very good, pertinent question. Mark, you want to take that, or would you like me to?
I don't know enough about what he did in the castle. I know in London it was quick, but
right.
As far as in the castle, that I'm not sure.
Okay,
so
well, in the castle, Holmes had rooms where he piped in gas that would slowly asphyxiate his victims. And what he would do is he would wait until they were knocked out. He would send them down into the basement where he had actual torture tables set up. And, yes, he would torture his victims to within a moment of their last breath and bring them back. And it was a game with him to where he would push them to the end and just see how much humanity would hold on to the very end. And basically, in his mind, he was playing God at the time.
Right.
He did some very bizarre things. Well, it's hypothesized that he had this stretching machine, and it was used for one of two purposes. He was either torturing his victims with it, which I believe, or he was using it because another conjecture came out that he wanted to create this mass race of giants, and he was trying to stretch people to be giants, and he was going to put them under his that's bizarre, but that's what came out, that he was going to put them under his control, under his will, and he was going to have this mass race of giants.
Okay, then.
There was a torture table down there. He had used many methods on torturing his victims. Nearly every corpse that they found, that they were able to find traces, they found traces of chloroform that he used prior to actually killing his victim. And chloroform, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but it actually, more than anything, it gives the sense of choking and being at the same time choking, you go dizzy, and you just, before you conk out, before you pass out from it, it's almost as though all your senses and your muscles and everything tense up, really tense, then you, all of a sudden, you're out of it. So, yeah, he did take pleasure in bringing about torture.
And I'm wondering with his medical background and being so intelligent, if in his method, he was actually trying to also see how much trauma a human body could take and still be alive, per se, you know?
Most definitely. Most definitely, that's one of the things he was doing.
Yeah. Remember, they were experimenting with this stuff in World War II Germany on the Jews, and this was pre that. So, yeah, he would have definitely been into that. Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, you know, and with him, you know how sometimes with serial killers, they get kind of sloppy the more they kill. But with him, he pretty much planned out his victims, right? He had a plan with each one. It wasn't like spur of the moment type killing, except for maybe the tie-in over in London, which those were quick. But were they even planned over there in London?
Well, with him, everything was planned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mark would agree with this. Holmes had if you want to say motive, everything was planned with him in his motive to better himself, to gain something from his motive, whether it was killing off, you know, a child, which he did, whether it was killing off one of his ex-wives, whether it was killing off a business partner, everything had a motive.
Yep.
He never killed anybody just for the sheer pleasure of saying, you know, I'm going to walk up to this person in the back alley and see what happens if I slice their throat. He did not do that in Chicago.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He didn't do that in London. Actually, he talked to them first.
Yes.
He actually talked to them because witnesses saw him talking to them, to the victims. And it was quite a while, so it wasn't a quick meet and kill. It was it took time.
Huh. That's interesting because, you know, most serial killers, a lot of times, they plan stuff, but then it might be for the moment type thing as well.
Yeah. One of the things it's almost impossible to find out, but the victims of the Ripper is I would like to know if somehow they were in any way connected to his classmate, in that his classmate was clients of the ladies of the evening there. And that is one of the things I would love to find out, but it's almost impossible without going back in time to find out. Because they sure didn't have a list.
Right. Or if you could tie the victims over in London with any kind of connection to the people that worked for Holmes or stayed in the hotel or whatnot,
mm-hmm.
if maybe he was per se cutting loose ends, cutting ties, you know, getting rid of those people as well. I don't know, but that would be interesting.
Well, one of the things he had written himself, Holmes, he had written that he enjoyed going to visit classmates, and he wrote that in his own hand, and that's why I was able to trace him then to Austin, Texas, because I got the list. It was great. I got a book from the University of Michigan that had all his classmates and where they came from. So it was easy to track down then and then to find out where exactly they lived. You know, they could have lived way outside of town, not even been close, but when you're within a block of where there's three or four murders, you know, you can kind of tell that's what he's there for.
Mm-hmm. Matt, did he, and this, you might have already answered this, but besides women, did he kill men?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
are you talking about Holmes or the Ripper?
Holmes.
Yeah, Holmes killed many men. Matter of fact, the one story was he took the guy that had the kiln that for his heat, the glass factory, and he burned him up alive.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And what I find interesting about Holmes is even the whole when he got caught for insurance fraud and the process of them executing him and then the way they buried his body, all that is just it just throws question marks up in the air about all of that. It's just really, you know, it's really weird in my eyes.
Well, that's why I had to restart everything, because so much information about him had been incorrect, and you have to restart looking at him. I think the perfect example is about the fire at the hotel, at his castle. A lot of stories say that it burned down to the ground, and it did not. It burned, but you were able to go inside. It was rebuilt, and then it stayed as the Sovereign Hotel into the 30s until it was finally torn down for the post office. We have pictures of it. And I got that from the library there in Chicago.
Yeah, and with that, I mean, I don't know if it's on the Bloodstains website or, Dane, I think you had it on your site a while ago. Mark, I
don't remember seeing it on yours, but from the location and the plot lines and everything else, it's actually just a hair off from where the post office is of the original outside wall. But
correct.
when you look at the old photographs of that area, the train tracks that run behind it, those
mm-hmm.
have been there. They're a solid staple to get a perspective of from that photo.
Yep.
Now the post office was put slightly off. Well, the post office is centered to several properties, whereas Holmes Castle was right up against the curb line on the one side. But from what I've
correct.
Seen on a video, is some of the basement actually still exists. The walls themselves, the exterior walls, aren't there. But underneath the grass plot is actually some of the basement yet still existing.
Yeah,
which I found
fascinating. I should have clarified that. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. None of the above-ground exterior walls are there, but the below-ground exterior walls are definitely there. There's a passageway
mm-hmm.
that goes to a dead end. It goes about, I think, Dane, you know this, it goes, 30, 40 feet back and then makes a 90-degree right?
Yeah, about 40 feet back and then right, yeah.
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 So, and that's one of the original things. You know, and here's a comparison that I like to make to people. If you've ever seen The Diary of Sweeney Todd with Johnny Depp, and of the Murder Castle design with the body
mm-hmm.
shoot and all that stuff,
mm-hmm. yes.
that had a huge, huge play in the development of that movie.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to read the original Sweeney Todd story to see if that was in, because I've seen that in the play before, too, when it was done locally. I didn't see the movie, but I did see that in a play. But one of the things I did find out about Holmes was he got a lot of his ideas from literature, and even the name Jack the Ripper actually comes from literature, from The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And there was a character in that book, or in that story, and his name was Hans von Ripper. And that was the owner of Ichabod's horse. And Hans in American English is Jack. So it was stuff like that. And also, if you read Poe, like Murders of the Rue Morgue, is incredible. And you start, when you read the murders themselves and the autopsies, they match the autopsies of the women in London.
Huh.
I
mean, it's spooky. It's actually spooky.
Yeah.
So, real quick, Kevin, Jody, you still with us?
Yeah.
Jody?
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. No, I know now, being the only female here dominated by a male a male interviewer, you have to have some questions.
And there's a pause.
And there must be no Jody.
Wait, what
I'm
did you say?
You.
Yes, I was talking. Clean out your ears. I was talking to you.
Okay, I'm with you.
All right. For the person that I know who is the least quiet person that I know, you've been the most quiet person that has been involved in this conversation.
Yes,
Kevin,
I have.
Would you agree with that? So,
you know, I would say out of everything that I've listened to, I'm more interested in the trial you know, and what went down with that, and, you know.
Well, in the Holmes trial, there wasn't, I mean, and guys, Dane and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, there really wasn't too much, like, oh, did he do it? It was cut and dry and done.
Yeah, they wanted to bring up more at his trial, but the judge says you don't really need to because we're just going to, you know, get him on this, and they, you know, he got the death sentence anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was predetermined to die no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
It, there wasn't anything that was going to change anything. The interesting thing about it, though, is, yeah, insurance fraud did get him. Like, that was the final thing. But It wasn't exactly insurance fraud. It was him swindling somebody else and them calling him out before anything.
Right.
So, I mean, when it comes down to it, 100%, and I hope you guys agree with me on this, it really did come down to greed.
Oh, yeah. I got to tell you a funny story that I found about him. The one letter that was that he wrote, it was while he was in prison, and it was to Honorable Sam Pennypacker. And Sam Pennypacker later became governor of Pennsylvania. But what I found out was he collected autographs. And he actually wanted Holmes's autograph. So that's why there's that one letter with Sam Pennypacker while Holmes was in prison in Philly, and it says from Herman Mudgett, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes.
Huh.
So, okay, now, initially, When we were supposed to have the first show and we had all the technical difficulties, and apparently the only difficulty tonight was Mark having to drive to McDonald's, which I brother, I applaud you for that, because yeah, you're driving around, and here's the mental image I have is you driving around with your cell phone in your hand waiting for three bars, and you can go, McDonald's, they have Wi-Fi.
Yep.
If you had to call
actually,
on via Skype.
I got to get going soon because they're closing up.
All right, well, real quick.
Real quick, I got a question. What's going on with the movie? Was it a movie film about this?
Yeah, the last I had heard was, as far as a Holmes movie, Leo DiCaprio has the rights to it, but I haven't heard anything more on it.
Yeah, so Dane and Mark both, Mark, I know you're getting kicked out of McDonald's Playland. Sorry we got to get you out of the little plastic balls, but it's going to be time to go shortly.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I need two things from you guys in last closing comments. Is one, what's like the most groundbreaking thing that you guys are hoping to get out of Holmes, or what you've come across personally is the most groundbreaking information? And two, websites and contact info or anything like that. Dane, I know you got books. Mark, I know you got publications out there, so we got about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I think my biggest revelation was finding, you know, at first I thought the Ripper was somebody completely different, and that's what I was starting to research, and it just didn't come together. Nothing matched, and then I just happened to be reading a story about Sherlock Holmes, and so I started looking up Holmes and come up around across H.H. Holmes, and I had no clue who he was, and that was a shame because the history just kind of wiped him out. And I think to study him is very major in any criminology course because he covered just about everything. I mean, he didn't leave too many stones unturned. He, you know, con artist and insurance fraud and murder and you name it, he did it.
Yeah, so, Mark, if you want to take a second and give any contact information, publications, websites, stuff like that, it's your floor, boss.
The Whitechapel Society has been fantastic. That's who I did my writing with. And honestly, one of the biggest helps also was the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. They were great to deal with because I got the – they kind of previewed everything, the people there. And it was kind of neat to see what their reactions were. And they're very great. And then also the National Archives of the UK, when I told them, you know, what I was finding, they say, please, you know, put it here. You know, put it here. You know, I got requested to put it here. You know, that was really cool. And then I contacted the mayor's office in London, and they said, oh, we're forwarding it to Scotland Yard's museum. I said, cool, you know, that's awesome. Now, I haven't heard anything since. That was back in February, but, you know, I'm hitting places that a lot of people say they can't get to, and it's like, you know, I'm taking my time, I haven't hurried, and it seems awfully slow, but I'm getting in, you know, into places that nobody else has been able to do, and that really makes me happy. But the people at the University of Michigan and the library there and down in San Antonio and Austin, they were just absolutely fantastic to work with. I can't say enough. And my reporter friend here in Reading, Jason Kale, I mean, he did a really nice piece concerning my work. And WFMC had done a piece earlier, but sadly the video is gone. It's in video land somewhere. We have no clue how it disappeared, but it's gone.
That's upsetting.
Yeah, because it showed exactly how I was able to match up the handwriting. So that's extremely disappointing.
Yeah. So, Dane, real quick, you want to throw out any plugs you want to put out there, any contact information, anything like that?
Well, you know, as far as anything groundbreaking, it's all going to be in my book, Dr. H.H. Holmes and the Whitechapel Ripper. There are so many things from the time Holmes was a child to the time he was allegedly hanged in the gallows. It's phenomenal, the amount of information that we thought we knew that we didn't know, or we were just fed sensationalism. And we've unearthed so much that this is going to be historic. As far as it's going to be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's going to be audio book. You're going to be able to purchase it through, like I say, the normal avenues. And you can read more about what I'm doing, what my book is, and updates as well on my website, www.danewig.com. And I always look forward to friends hitting me up on Facebook, too. You got a question or want to know something about Holmes or the Ripper, feel free to ask me. I look forward to hearing from anyone. And I just want to say that, you know, thank you, Matt, and for having me on tonight. I appreciate being on and the opportunity to pick up where we left off last week.
Yeah.
You know, and Mark, we'll be talking again this week, you know.
Yep.
And I just want to say that, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be on the show here with everyone.
Yeah, well,
thank you for coming.
Yeah, you know you're always welcome, man. I mean, and hey, the warm weather for us is right around the corner, so we got to do some riding.
That sounds like a winner with me.
Yeah.
And that is definite. And Jody, thank you. And I think
yes,
it's Kevin,
thank you very
right?
much.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
And all of you have a great night too.
Yes.
All
thank
right.
you very much, everybody.
Wow.
Yeah.
If anybody's interested,
I know you're getting kicked out of the ball pit. Wait, they cut out? Yeah. Mark, you got kicked out of the ball pit?
Yeah, I'm out of the ball pit, but I'm in my car. actually, I have everything posted in my photo section, and my reports are in there, too, the articles from the Whitechapel Society. So if anybody's interested, they could easily go into my photo section on my Facebook page, and I have it public. So anybody can read anything that they want. You know, that's fine. I have all the pictures. I have all the handwriting matches and everything there. I've tried to keep it as open as possible.
Well, that's the best way to do it. You're going to, get that information out there. There might be a piece that comes along, you know.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I got tired of was people saying, well, I know who it is, but I'm not telling. And it's like, dude, that's just so dumb.
Yeah.
You know, I had heard that so many times, and I got just so fed up with it. I thought, you know, I'm going to do the Ben Franklin approach and just bring it out and see what happens. And so far it's been positive. It's been slow, but it's been very positive. I've gotten very positive reactions from it. I mean, even the handwriting specialist, this is ironic. I got her through the library over there in London, and she happens to be from Reading, England, and I'm from Reading, PA. You know, it's
small world.
It's just funny that way.
That's a small, big world.
Yeah. It's just really funny. And I have, you know, if anybody says, oh, you know, there's something wrong with it, I have all my emails and everything. There's just, I can prove everything. I get everything backed up.
Yeah. And, hey, real quick, Jody and Kevin, what do you got going on the epic show Terrify next Tuesday?
We have a friend of mine that's going to be speaking at my conference, Brandon Garrett. He's out of Conroe, Texas, and he is a Bigfoot hunter and actually has a Bigfoot team that goes out and hunts. So we're going to talk Bigfoot Tuesday.
Yeah, that's definitely something I thought. You know what? I love the cryptozoology stuff, and that is something I'll be tuning in for. So we got 1 minute left. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Jody. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Dane.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again,
so
everyone.
It's definitely been a pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
Kevin, you were saying something?
Oh, I didn't say anything. But, yeah, tune in tomorrow for Ghost Hunting Texas Style with Kevin and Justin Eric, 8 p.m. Central Time. Little plug for the network. There you go.
Kevin, I'm gonna catch you on that program. I want to find out what kind of bait you use to catch a Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, Shirley, we are definitely off air in 3, 2, 1, 0.
Bye.
But, yeah, Dane, thank you, man. It's definitely always a pleasure. I mean, I'm sorry if I tear into you a little bit or tear into the situation with my ideas a little bit. It's just, I don't know. I think of it, and I think of it from not a researcher's perspective. I think of it from a psychological analyst perspective.
Oh, no, that's cool, dude.
So.
No problem.
Oh, dude.
No problem. And I was just glad because I wanted to hear more of Mark today and stuff. And I'm just glad that you asked more direct questions for him. I know that I kind of took the show last week, so I was really happy to hear him.
Yeah. Well, also last week, and Kevin and I were talking about this, that and Jody and Kevin had a problem last night to where the show completely dropped and they had to bring it back up.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Blog Talk, well, Kevin and Jody, Dane used to do a show called You for My Loft that, and it was on Blog Talk too, but he hasn't done that for a while. But
it's got to be too much with what everything I'm writing, yeah.
Yeah, I guess what's happening is there's like viruses that are attacking the, or not viruses, but just issues that are attacking the mainframe of Blog Talk, and it's messing with everybody's shows. Like, Kevin, how many people had to call their shows last night?
Just about everybody. Well, I know several people that actually called their show. We actually stuck with it and got back on air, but a lot of them just gave up. And they emailed me and said it's during the prime time hours, which is what our shows are every night, is during 8 to 10 Central Time, and that's when they're having the most issues. So, but I gave them a pretty hefty cussing out yesterday in my email, so I told them to get it fixed. My network's gone, and we didn't have a glitch tonight, so maybe they heed the warning.
Well, that's good. That's good. Hey, Matt, I'm going to ask a favor of you.
Yes, sir.
Can you forward me or send, however you do that with Facebook, send me a link to both Kevin and Jody's page so that I could put them on my, you know, friend them on my Facebook page, because I do want to listen to his program tomorrow.
Yeah, that's no problem at all. Well,
cool.
Kevin, you're on Sunday, or Kevin is on Sundays, and then Kevin and Jody are on Sunday or on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Well, but yeah, I'll send you a link to Terrify and Kevin. Dude, you gotta start promoting your show. I don't even know what your show is called on Sunday.
it's named after my group, Unknown Paranormal Radio.
Yeah, that's what I thought, but I never saw.
Yeah.
I never put that together when I saw Unknown Paranormal Radio Network as a show. I thought that you were just promoting what it was, but it never popped up with the name.
No, you know, the difference is the network is URN, Unknown Radio Network. And my show, that was the very beginning before I created the network, we were always called Unknown Paranormal Radio. That's the show. And I actually have a page, too, just like Terrify, a fan page that's Unknown Paranormal Radio.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Matt, what you were talking about with the book, actually, it works out very well because I don't know if you saw today that John Zaffis was discussing an issue in the paranormal community, which I can use a chapter from my book and give you that, which talks about the same issue that John was talking about today on Facebook about demons and demonology. and how it's affecting the paranormal community. So I think that works out well. So we'll get together on that.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And Jody.
Yeah.
And I know, Dane, we haven't talked about this, but Jody and her son were just on My Ghost Story on Bio.
Oh, really?
And also, on top of that, Jody and her son are going to be writing a chapter in the book of the, but I'm just going to call it like the Paranormal Unity book for right now. So obviously that is not going to be the title. Like, you got to get something a little more edgy. But yeah, it'll, her and her son will be on there. And she filmed the spot with 2020. That's going to be aired too with her son.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So that's why Kevin had to deal with my stupid ass for a couple weeks.
Right. Well, I'm actually working on something right now with a network too, but I don't really want to let the cat out of the bag. I'll let you know about it when it evolves next week.
Very nice.
Yep.
Damn you, Dan.
Good luck with that.
Pardon me?
I said
Dan,
good luck with that.
Thanks.
Dan, I love you, but you always leave me salivating, and I hate that.
Well, well, that's all part of, you know, putting the carrot out there, my friend.
Yeah, I know. So... I'm sick of the carrot. I'm a goddamn horse. I'm sick of the carrot. I want the apple.
Right?
All right, well, I'm going to hit it so the show's over.
Yeah,
but it was
yeah,
a pleasure.
Right, me too.
And, you know, Matt, if you'll send us, like, his Facebook profile, so...
Yeah.
We can friend both of them.
Excellent.
Yeah, for sure. Well, here.
Good luck with
what
everything, you know?
Jody, you might want to repeat that.
Yeah, I didn't hear
it. I was just telling him good luck with everything, you know?
Oh, okay. Thanks. I appreciate it. And
yeah.
I look forward to following both the radio program and seeing the stuff on TV.
Yeah. All right, great. You guys have a good night.
You too.
Yeah. You too. Good night, dear. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
All right, so it's down to the guys, huh? But no, yeah. Same. Thank you. And I mean, it means a lot that 2 weeks in a row that you take time out of your schedule, because I know how busy it is, that you would come on and talk again for another 2 hours.
No, that's okay, bud. You know, I appreciate the fact that you wanted to continue it, because I wasn't happy where it ended off last week, and I understand that it was out of your control, you know. You know, it's nothing you can do about it. It's just something that happens. And, you know, like I say, I'm just happy to be able to be on.
Yeah, it's something that Kevin and I have been talking about. And, Kevin, I know you're probably more frustrated than anybody about it.
Yeah. And
we had to leave it where it was just because they're... Nobody could talk. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Now, Kevin, you're doing TV and radio?
No, I'm just doing the radio.
Mm. Okay.
But here's something, and, well, Dane, when you slow down. But, Kevin, I swear to God, if you paid Dane... a lot of money, it would be worth it.
to do research. What Kevin's trying to set up right now, and I'm not going to give location or anything else because Kevin will literally fly up to Illinois and kick my ass. But he's looking at buying a abandoned. Is it a hospital or mental asylum?
It's a hospital.
Yeah, an abandoned hospital that has a shit ton of activity down in Texas, and setting up to where groups and whatever can come down there and investigate and see what they get.
Really?
Yep.
That's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely is. Yeah, it'll be a good thing for this part of Texas. We don't have this kind of a facility to do research in, so it would definitely be a great thing for the paranormal field. Especially,
right.
especially the fact that the owner is a paranormal investigator, so it's going to be tailored for investigations, you know, because I've been in the field a good while now, so I know what the teams and whatnot need to go in there.
Right, right.
Yeah, I just, I didn't want to, well, Kevin, you haven't exactly told me either of... You're like, you know what? You and Dane are like brothers. It's like, oh, you know, I'm gonna dangle the carrot in front of you, but fuck no, you're not gonna find out what it's about.
Well, that's how you keep them interested.
Yeah.
Well, Dane, obviously, you know I'm still interested no matter what. I mean,
well,
shit,
right.
How long have I been talking and working with Jeff, too?
Right, but I mean, you know, and dude, you know, you do have to say that you and I have sat down and we've talked and I've told you things and I've said, hey, dude, you know, this is on the down low, don't say anything, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's some things I've told you that you know and you're privy to without other people knowing.
Yeah.
You know.
Then you know has never gotten out.
Right. Right. So don't say that you always get the carrot. Sometimes you do get the steak.
Yeah, sometimes I do. But on air, I get the carrot.
Well, yeah.
In record, yes, I admit I get the steak.
Well, I don't know. In the last 2 weeks, dude, I've dropped a few good ones on the audience, so.
Yeah.
And I'm getting, dude, I kid you not, man, I'm getting so much feedback from people on notoriety about the book and about people just telling me that they've heard so much about it. And I'm not just talking about local. I'm talking on a national scale. And it's really exciting, dude. Really is.
Oh, yeah, that I can imagine. And yeah, Kevin, seriously, Piercing the Veils of Death, just that book alone. I mean, Dane, what is it, a couple bucks on Amazon?
Yeah, but just so you know, I'm probably in the next, I'll say 2 months, I'm gonna do an edited and revised version. Because there were a few things I wanted to fix in it. But, yeah, it's just a couple bucks on Amazon.
Yeah, it's definitely well worth it. I mean, if you got a Kindle, you got an iPad, you know, anything, well, pretty much any device now. Yeah, like, check it out, seriously. It's ridiculously good.
Okay, sounds good.
Well, thanks, I appreciate that, dude. Means a lot.
Well, I have to give credit where credit is due. There's been some books that I've read of people that who, you know, first book, and I assume that that's how mine would go if I wrote one. That aren't so good, but yeah, it will go down. And my top two or three is one of the best books ever written.
Well, just know that if you ever do decide to write a book, your first book is always a learning curve.
And it will be horrible.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it is a learning curve. After you get that first one out there and then you go through the bumps and you get a couple of thorns in your hand, and then you'll know what to look out for on your next book. That's why things are going a little bit smoother on this book now. It's intense research, but it's just going to go so much smoother when it comes to putting everything together. I mean, I'm already putting things together, but when it comes to actually everything solidifying.
Yeah. Well, speaking of books, which, Kevin, I know you saw a little bit about it.
Yeah.
Here's the beautiful part, is I'm putting together a book. I'll send you the information offline, but it has nothing to do with actually me writing the book. It does, because I'm doing two chapters, but besides that, it promotes paranormal unity, like David Rountree and Tracy Ray and everybody else has been trying to develop over the years. I did ask Dane, and these may possibly be able to contribute, but he's busy as hell, and I completely understand that. But some of the people that are going to be involved, and Dane, I didn't tell you this either. I talked to Ben Henson from Factor Faked, and he has to talk to his publishers to find out if it's okay under his contractual obligations that he currently has. But the for sures are John Zaffis, Jason Gates, Brian Kano, Chelsea Namali, Helmy Kramer, Josh Gates, he has to look at his contract too to see if he can do it. But also Jody, her son, Brittany, Sarah, they keep adding up and adding up and adding up.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, you got to throw a chapter in, man. I'm sorry.
I already told you I would.
I know. I got to throw you under the book bus. You're obligated no matter what.
Sounds good to me.
You've asked me, and you know what? I'll take one off the chalkboard. But you've asked me to go to shows with you, and I've been right there. Well, I did one, but I'm asking you to contribute a chapter for the book.
Okay.
So.
Well, guys, I got to get running. I got to get running here.
All right, Dan, brother. Thank you. Have a good night.
We'll talk this
week. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, definitely.
Kevin, it was nice talking to you and meeting you, and I'll look for that Matt to send me that Facebook site. And Matt, we'll talk this week, okay?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, and I'll talk to you guys later. Thanks again tonight.
All right.
Good night, Dan. Good night, Kevin.
All right. Bye bye.
And thank you, everybody, still listening. That is the conclusion of Full Spectrum Radio. As you know, we always run into archive. So appreciate the support, everything. Thank you, Dane. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Jody. Thank you, Mark. It was definitely an interesting evening. So, good night. Love y'all. And I will see you next week. And hopefully Dennis will be back with us. Also, Monday night, Full Spectrum Radio. No, Monday night. See, I get them confused. Monday night is Into the Darkness with Brittany Johnson, where her and I will be on. So check it out Monday, same place, same time. And I will post the link. Good night, everybody.